All
So you should
right.
be the co-host now. So hopefully,
Yeah, that's fine.
hopefully a fresh laptop helps.
I hope so too. Okay, can you now see all slides and all it's
Well, you switch between them. Okay, yes.
okay.
Very good.
Thank God. Okay. Yeah. I don't know. I don't know what happened. He just died. Just said no, please stop. Okay, I'm sorry for that. I will just leave out some boring parts to catch up the time. Okay. Back again for the third time to the components of machine learning. So we learned that if we need to visualize or inspect data we want to feed in our algorithm, we can use data frames, which are very helpful tools. Talking about the algorithm themselves, there are different types. So far, I talked about neural network, the support vector machine, random forest, Gaussian processors, and so on. There are different learning strategies. We discussed so far supervised learning, right? So where I tell the algorithm how the target values specifically look like. We also learned about different minimization techniques, and also how to use validation data, right? So we avoid overfitting. And we also talked a bit about hyperparameter optimization. So how do we find the best setting for our algorithm? if we then have used the algorithm on our data, then we get some outputs, however this might look like, and we have to evaluate the output, right? So either we look at residuals in case of data regression, we look at the ROC curve, the confusion matrix, or whatever metric you fancy. So yeah, on Tuesday, I started to talk about hyperparameter optimization for a neural network. We tried a grid search algorithm, so right, you have a set of parameters, and for each of these parameters, you have a range you vary. And depending on how complex your data, your model is, you might have to try many, many parameter combinations, which might take a lot of time, but also does not ultimately guarantee that you find the best set of parameters that optimizes your problem. Another approach I like to briefly discuss here is the random walk search. This is one of the, funny enough, but this is one of the most more, let's say, better performing algorithms. So what you do is you explore your parameter space by random selection. I will explain this in a second. And the nice thing is that you can add selection rules, like you can tell the algorithm that the neural net should rather grow in depth on width rather than the other way around, right? So you can tell how the network shall grow or which parameter shall kept frozen for a certain amount of time. So this is how a random parameter search, a random walk parameter search might look like. So what you do is, let's say you want to train a neural network, right? You start with a random set of parameters like number of neurons and number of hidden layers. And what you do is you train your model, and you determine the performance on the validation data. Okay, so then you have a valid performance, like I don't know, an accuracy of 90%. Fine. What you then do is you randomly update the parameters, so you switch to a new set of parameters, like you change the number of neurons from, let's say, 5 to 6. I don't know, and you add one hidden layer, for instance. Train this model again, determine again the efficiency. Let's say you obtain now an accuracy of 89%, right? What you then do is you compare the new result with the previous one and see if there's an improvement. If there's improvement, so if you see that the new set of parameters shows a better performance, you simply continue with the next search. So you keep the new set of parameters as the current ones. If you see that if you see that your performance is not better, as I said, like 90% versus 89%, then you say, ah, okay. I basically roll a dice. So I say, I give it a doubt and still give it a chance to make it through because, again, the performance might, depending which performance I use, it might not be the best criterion. So I give it a chance to still keep the set of parameters depending on the probability I basically throw. If it turns out to be a low score, then you keep this parameter set. If it's a high score, then you do the walk again, right? So you just keep constantly looking for, update the parameters if you see an improvement. If you don't see an improvement, roll dice, and depending on the outcome, you might discard or keep this new set of parameters. Okay. This is a result of the random search. So we used a score, we used the MCC, right, which we introduced on Tuesday. And this is the parameter setting. So you see, we, instead of 81 parameter settings we tried last time, it's just 50. I just chose this number. You can go higher or lower, whatever you want. But as you can imagine, because it's a random search, it's more likely that you have to look search longer, right? Just to increase the likelihood to find an optimum setting. If you look at this plot, you see some variation, which is fine. It's a much larger variation than the one we obtained for the grid search, which is already a sign that we explore a wider range just by its randomness. You also see this plateau-like things, right? So where the score like nearly doesn't change. So this is the case and where you did the random update of the parameter, so you changed the number of neurons, the number of hidden layers, but you didn't find any improvement in the performance. This is not bad, but if you observe this to be like over a very long period, like here, this is an indication that the algorithm might get stuck. And this is one disadvantage of these random search algorithms, right? That they might get stuck on one level. Again, the algorithm we are discussing here is a very stupid one. It's just randomly walking. In more advanced algorithms, you might include things like let's say like temperature like parameter, which kind of forces the algorithm to leave this local minimum. Again, like I showed last week, if you pick out a few set of parameters, like on the left, the performance versus the activation function in the neural network, you see again that the identity activation function is in most cases underperforming compared to the other ones. And here you see the number of hidden layers. The function for the MCC. If you now look at the performance of the algorithm itself, these are the rock curves. So on the left column always shows you the worst performing model, basically the loser, if you want to call it like that. And the right column shows you the best performing model. And if you compare these curves to the ones we discussed last week with the grid search, you see the performance is quite similar. Right, we again see some weird structures here in this probability distribution. But again, this on the first glance it shows you okay the algorithm seems the winning model kind of seems to be reasonable even though we have to pay attention to the structures here. What I forgot to mention last week, these structures are in most cases related to the number of hidden layers. So the more hidden layers you have, the more likely it might be that these structures show up in a probability distribution. It's not always like that, but this is one indicator for that. So more hidden layers might cause the probability distribution to look like this, depending on how you train it and how long you train it. There's already a summary for this. So we found a winning model with an MCC score of 0.73 after 50 parameter searches. It has, if you remember, it has exactly the same score as the model found by the grid search. Okay, and the performances are comparable. On the one hand, this might be frustrating, but on the other hand, it's a good sign because if two different approaches show the same result, this is not a bad thing. However, in this case, the rock curves look slightly more reasonable because our model looks a bit different than the one found by the grid search. The funny thing is, the winning model ended up having 7 layers. So, if you experience machine learning, you will immediately say, okay, based on this problem, right, 3 species with 3 features each, 7 hidden layers is just too much because the problem is kind of well-defined. 7 hidden layers sounds ridiculous, and it is, but it's understandable because I set the probability to there's a parameter in my random search. I call it the probability for the network to either grow in width or in depth, and it's more likely that this guy grows in gets deeper than wider. Right? You see the corresponding probabilities. I just set it. These settings are just for fun, right? after the results, we saw now we might change the setting and say, okay, maybe we should change this percentage more to, I don't know, 30%, and maybe this guy a bit larger, right? As I said, the nice thing about these random searches, we are not limited to a grid, is you can always add constraints, right? You can always add constraints, like you can constrain the number of maximum layers, or you can include into your validation estimation, you can include constraint terms or punish terms, so that you kind of include the cost, right? Network with many parameters costs more than a network with smaller parameters in terms of computational time. Right? So these are always things you can add and make this random search much more effective, produce more reasonable results. Again, this is just an example how a random search could look like, right? This is not how people should do it. There are many more things you should have, you need to include in order to make this work. But I just want to give you an idea how a random search could look like. And you already see that even though it didn't outperform the model from the grid search, but it already shows more advantages. Right? But there are many algorithms on the market that do this hyperparameter optimization for you, either random based or much more sophisticated. I put one here called the Spearman Bayesian Optimizer. It's on GitHub, so if you click on this link, it's a clickable link again, you get redirected to a GitHub repository, and there's a nice documentation with a paper and stuff how this optimizer works actually. And it makes use of a Gaussian processor like algorithm. So yeah, I at some point in the future when you have to do a hyperparameter optimization, I highly encourage you to check this guy out. All right. This is so far for the hyperparameter optimization. There are many things you can say. The first thing most people do is to start to tune their models by hand, and after a long time, when you get tired, you go to these algorithms. So again, which algorithm you choose is up to you. Most important thing is that you know what you are doing. All right. If there are no urgent questions, I would like to now go to deep learning. All right. So nowadays, deep learning seems to be a buzzword. It's pretty amazing. It's like you write deep learning on a proposal, and all of a sudden you get all the funds you can dream of, or nearly all the funds. It's really funny. Just to tell you in advance, deep learning is a subsection of machine learning. It's still machine learning. Why is it called deep? I will explain in a second. So now remember our example from the beginning, right? I tortured you with this quadratic function, and we tried to fit it with a multilayer perceptron and a Gaussian processor. I promised I would not talk about it again, but I didn't find any better example. So yeah, here's it again. So assume I give you this data sets, right? So you see these black points, this is the measured data, and I'm telling you, yeah, find me a function that fits this thing. Of course, you would not use a machine learning approach. You would use a polynom. But again, you could use a machine, why not? For fun, it works. But the thing is now, what do we know about this data? Not much, right? We have these points, okay, but you don't know how did I get to this data, right? Of course, I generated it in Python, but in real nature, this data might come from experiment, right? So maybe there are already some pre-processing steps involved, right? If you know what I mean, like calibration, background suppression, all these fancy things. Maybe some events have been removed. Maybe there has also some tracking algorithm been involved. You don't know. So what I'm trying to say is this data might come already after a certain analysis step, right? So one question is, what happens if we look at the data before all this pre-processing, right? So basically, how does this picture look like right after the measurement? And this is one. How it could look like, right? So imagine we have two detectors, right? One Y sensor and one Z X sensor, and it just measures whatever it measures of some quantity, and we see these are the data points. And what I just did is I kind of took the mean over here, right? So I took the mean in this for this X value, and the mean in this X value, and then came to this picture, right? This is how I could have calibrated the data, or maybe there was some linear function involved, or whatever. But the question is, what will you do if I give you this picture, right, without doing any pre-processing? And just by looking at it, we see, for instance, that certain pixels, right, like those guys, they show a certain correlation, right? I mean, if you now directly look at it, you see, okay, there's a quadratic function involved. And of course, I drew the red line to guide the eye, but you immediately see, okay, there's some correlation between these points, right? You just see it. Whereas those guys here, those points here, those group of pixels doesn't show any correlation. So one question that you can ask is, okay, what happens if I just give this picture with all just the pixel information to a machine, right? So again, I ask a machine to do the job for me. So I don't want to deal with event filtering and calibration and reconstruction and whatnot. I just want the machine to do it for me. I can do that. Possibility is to, for instance, use a deep convoluted neural net. So I will not talk about these convolutional neural nets because this would take another lecture, right? But just to give you an idea how this looks like, so these networks are designed to analyze images, right? So you read an image. What they do is they basically scan the image in group of pixels, right? Called the kernel, and then they translate them to features and then go to another feature map and so on, and then go to hidden layers and whatnot. So this is a gigantic model. We are talking about lots and lots of parameters, like in the order of thousands and millions, right? Again, you do not need to understand the complete detail of this convolutional neural net, but this is one model that could analyze our data, right? This pixelated data without us doing anything, without providing any information. And that's, in a very naive picture, the basic idea of deep learning, right? Again, as I said, in a very naive picture, we have data. Let's say we have data and there's no prior information, as I said, no calibration, no event selection. We did not even specify the variables. Like, we did not say, oh, look at momentum, energy deposits, and I don't know, time. We just provide the data and say, oh, yeah, the data happens to have, I don't know, 500 variables, and then give it to the machine. This data that is not pre-processed or pre-analyzed is, of course, larger, right? Imagine you have data freshly out of the detector, right? TDC and ADC values. There's no calibration or whatever involved. So you have the raw values, and those data sets are most likely larger. So the information content is larger, right? This means also, if you use this raw data, that the model has to do the pre-processing for us, right? So up to now, in quotation marks, classic machine learning, we, the humans, did the pre-processing, right? We took the data and then said, okay, we just filter out these three features for our species, and then I give it to you guys and ask you to do the classification. But now we leave out this step. We have the raw data, which might be much more than three features, five or 10, whatever. And so the model has to do this for us, right? And this is where neural nets come in, because the information processing in a neural network happens inside a layer, right? Because this is all a layer in the neural net does. It just does something with the information we provide. It just transforms numbers. And by adding more hidden layers, we add more processing operators, basically. Yeah? So the more, it might sound stupid, but let's say the less information you fold into the data, the more pre-processing you need to do, meaning you have to add more layers inside the network to do the processing for you. And this means the model becomes deep. This is how you call a deep neural net, right? There's a very nice plot. Again, I stole it from this Deep Learning for Science school. Again, the link here is clickable. That shows you the performance of the two approaches versus the amount of data. So amount of data. That could be either not only the size of the data, but also the number of features. Again, if you have well-defined pre-processed data, then you see the both are performing similarly well. But let's say you leave out the pre-processing stage, then you see that machine learning at some point just saturates, right? Performance doesn't get any better. And you can try that either, actually. I tried it myself just for fun on a large raw data set. I tried to work with a decision tree. The decision tree just failed, didn't show any performance. So this is when you have to include deep learning. But what does it mean, a deeper model, yeah, right? So we have more layers. Deeper model means the training time becomes longer, right, and more extensive because we have more parameters to add. And therefore, we need algorithms or software to handle this. And of course, you can always try to write this stuff on your own. Fine, no one will stop you, but this is painful. But fortunately, there are many, many frameworks to do this training of these deep models. There are many pitfalls in training deep models. I will not talk about these because, again, this will take another two lectures. But just let me tell you that training a deep neural net, I mean, training any machine learning model is not trivial, but training a deep neural net is more not trivial. One of these frameworks is the TensorFlow Keras, TensorFlow Keras, right? So Keras provides a large machine learning library for different, for you to customize your model. So you can define, is it a multi-layer perceptron? Is it a recurrent network? Is it a image processing network, convolution network? What kind of network is it? And TensorFlow kind of handles for you the optimized training and data pre-processing for the network. And in the following slides, I will show a very, very simple example how to use TensorFlow. So I will not discuss with you in detail how to train a deep neural net, right? This will just take long. I will just show a very trivial example just to give you an idea how to include this framework in your analysis, and just to show you the minor difference to scikit, which we have been talking about so far. Okay. So in Keras, a model is defined by a sequence of layers, and so you have the initial layer, then the first hidden layer, second, and so on until the last hidden layer, and the data is passed through the sequence of layers or processing steps, if you want to call it like that. So what you do is, you when you set up your model, you set up a sequential model, right? That's a sequence of layers. That's all you do. So this is now a model, right? This model has no architecture. It's just a sequence of something. And now we have to define the layers, right? The hidden layers of the model. How do they look like? How many neurons? And so, and the following will show you the high flexibility of Keras, right? You remember in scikit, we were able to determine the number of hidden layers and then the activation layer of each neuron. In Keras, you can define the activation function of each hidden layer, right? In scikit, it's more global. Here, it's individual. Here's an example. So I define my first hidden layer. I tell it how many neurons it has. They are called units here. Yeah? So this is the first hidden layer right after I put in the three variables from our classification example. It has five hidden layers. Because it's the first hidden layer, I tell it, okay, you will get three input variables, which corresponds to the three features of the species we are looking at. And then I tell it, you have the activation function of tangents. We can also set a ReLU or the identity or whatever you want to look at, right? But we are using the tangents now. And then something very important, this is it's called kernel and bias initializer. It's just the initialization of the bias, right? Because when you start training a network, you randomize. You set the start bias randomly. So this is what this guy does. And it's just it's a normal distribution. And then I can define another hidden layer, right? I just do the same. And if I define the last layer, I have to tell it, okay, you have three outputs, right? Remember, we are looking at our data set with the three species. So we want to have three predictions. And as I said, I explained in the second lecture, we set the output function to be the softmax. Remember the softmax, this is the function that only gives values between 0 and 1. And if you add all the output values from the output layer, you always end up with 1. Yeah. So what scikit kind of did internally, we have to do it manually in Keras. You might not say, okay, this is kind of unnecessary. Well, it depends on what you want to do, right? If you simply want to run a classification, of course you would use scikit. But if you really have to customize your model and you really need individual activation functions and different initializers, I mean, this might happen depending on which data set you're looking at, then of course you would use Keras. So after we have defined our layers, what we just do is we add them to the sequence we defined before. This is done here. I just like it. It's a, right. You tell your model, okay, now I add the first hidden layer. I add another hidden layer. And I mean, if you look, I mean, you can add as many layers as you want, right? So in this case, we just have two hidden layers and then add the final layer. That's all. Now you have set up your model with a certain architecture, right? Then you define your optimizer. Remember, the optimizer is the algorithm that does the loss minimization for you, that the gradient search that finds that sets the weights for you. In this case, we use the gradient descent again, the similar one to the scikit, and we also define a learning rate like here. And then you have to compile your model. This is also nice because if you screwed something up, defining the layers or activation functions. When you compile your model, it will complain. So this is nice. You also have to define you can individually define the loss function. This is basically like the log loss kind of thing, but for multi-classes. You can also set the loss to the mean squared error or mean absolute error, or you can even, because you can even customize your loss function. Also possible, right? So again, you have a very high flexibility here. And then you have this nice line. I really like it because it gives a summary of your model, like shown here. So it tells me, yeah, your model is sequential. Aha, I know. Then it tells me the first dense layer. Dense layer is just a fully connected layer, like in the multilayer perceptron. We have 5 neurons in this in layer. Like I said, these are 20 parameters in total. And this is the output layer with 3 outputs. Oh, yeah. This guy has 18 parameters, including the incoming information. So you have 38 parameters in total. Wow, that's cool. And you can also set the individual parameters trainable or not. So you can specifically define weights that should be changed during training or not. Again, this is also something that might happen if you have to retrain a model and know that a certain group of weights shall not be optimized. All right. And that's all. Now we have our model, we have compiled it. Technically, we could just train on the data. But there's one small detail we have to take care about. And I'm just mentioning it just to make you aware of it. And so in scikit, the number of outputs was set automatically, depending on the number of species we provided, right? We told the model we have three species, so the model automatically had 3 outputs. And then it is so nice to translate the output of the network, right? These values between 0 and 1, it translates them for us to labels, right? And in Keras, this is you have to do it manually. For a simple task, painful, but if you need to customize something, that's a good thing. And what you just do is you just define a label vector. This is shown here, right? So you go in your data frame. Right, look at the label and then say if the label is 1, and define this vector, right, 0, 1, 0. If the label is 2, define the vector 0, 0, 1, and so on. And this is how your data looks like, right? So this is the data frame, remember? It's nearly the same like the one you analyzed in your homework. And instead of a label, we have now a label vector because we need to adapt it for Keras. And after this, we call the fit function, like in Keras. We specify the x values, which would be the 3 feature value of feature variables. Y in this case is not a single label, but it's a label vector. Fine. We define the number of epochs, and we define how many data shall be kept aside for validation. And also here, nice is you can define a history. The history basically summarizes the training history. So you can immediately plot the outcome. You can plot the loss from the training data and the loss from the validation data. Quite simple. And if you do this, you get this curve. And blue is the loss curve for the training data. And in orange, I believe it is, you get the loss for the validation data. You see here that the, okay, I didn't magnify it, but you see that orange curve here starts to rise up again. So this is the region where we lose on generalization. Okay. Then what I said before, scikit is so nice to translate for us the network output, right? The number, the continuous number between 0 and 1, translates them for us to a label. Again, we have to do it manually here in Keras. This is pretty simple. What we just do is if x is the prediction, we just pick the maximum, the output with the maximum prediction and label our event according to the number of the output. Right? So this is now the data frame after our analysis, right? So this was the initial data frame with the three variables, number 1, 2, 3, the labels, the label vector. This is the predicted label vector by the Keras model. And this is now the label after we applied this translation function, which is completely identical to the one in scikit. Yeah, and if you now see, for instance, the data of one event labeled as one means that the second output of the neural network should be show the largest value. It does. If you compare this line, and it ends up with one. There's an event labeled as zero, meaning that the first output of the neural net should show the largest value. Oh, it does, and it's also labeled as zero. So everything looks kind of reasonable here. And of course, after using training such a network, you always look at the outputs, right? We see here the raw outputs before translating them to labels. Right, for each species, we see the raw curve. If you compare it to the scikit ones, right, like shown here, there are some similarities, right? So both models seem to behave similar. Also, raw curves show similar features, right? If you look, for instance, the red curve here and the red curve here, so they look identical, nearly, right? Also, the confusion matrix more or less shows similar values. I mean, you're a bit better for species labeled with zero, but you're a bit worse in Keras with species number one. And you can also do all the other calculations. However, you see that the scikit neural net and the Keras neural net show a similar performance. And this is not surprising because I set up the Keras neural net in exactly the same way. I used the same number of hidden layers. I used the same number of neurons. I even used the same optimizer. I think also I used the same learning rate, if I recall correct. So everything was the same. So of course, if not something completely weird is going on, they should show similar performances, which they do. And this is something, if it happens to you that you have to use or that you're using different frameworks, or you want to test different frameworks on the same problem, it always helps to compare. If you have, let's say, you use framework A and use a decision tree and have framework B and use a decision tree as well, compare them. Because you might figure out what one framework is actually doing or not. This might help you to debug your model. Yeah. A few words on tensors. This is something you have to deal with when you're using TensorFlow. I mean, the name, tensor, right? Tensors are multidimensional objects. Yes, I print this table from the TensorFlow webpage. So a tensor with dimension zero is a single number. Ah, okay. A tensor of one dimension is a vector, right? For instance, here, a one-dimensional tensor with shape 5 means a five entries tensor. If the dimension number is 2, you have a matrix, right? You're going from a vector to a matrix. That's then one dimension more. If you then go to another dimension, you have a cube, right? So imagine you add to a matrix another dimension, then you have a three-dimensional object, which is a cube. Yeah, and then you go to higher dimensions, but I cannot imagine that. I'm just lost. This is important if you use TensorFlow because depending on which model you use, you just don't have an array of numbers, but you have a matrix of entries, and then you have to set up your model properly. I wasted hours on debugging my model because I didn't set up the shape of my input data properly. So you don't have to understand this in detail now. I'm just telling you this is something you have to keep in mind when using with TensorFlow. Why are we using tensors again? Tensors are algebraic objects, and using neural networks is nothing else than matrix multiplication, right? So this is why they use tensors, because they allow fast and flexible weight multiplication, basically, of passing the data through the neural net, which is helpful if you have a really dense or deep neural network. All right. This is just something I want to mention. So, as you know, Professor Dobbs is working for GlueX, and we are also using kind of a deep learning approach in GlueX physics. This is something we are currently working on. This is using a deep neural network for particle identification. I'm not going into the details. I just want to show you that we are using this technique as well, not because it's fancy, but because we figured out we have to. It helps us a great deal of understanding our data better. So you see, this is a network that reads in data, for instance, for electrons, five variables, momentum, the angle, and then some energy deposits in detectors. And this network is trained in a way that it is just trained to mimic the input data, right? So similar to an identity function. But as you see, the structure is very funny, because the number of neurons decreases towards the middle and then increases. This is a feature of the autoencoder. So the information, the five input features are compressed to just two. And then this helps you to understand the correlation inside your data better. Right? And there are many more advantages, but I don't want to go into details. And then a few remarks, just to put things into a bigger context. Machine or deep learning, I mean, these are nowadays buzzwords, but they are not so different to fitting a function, right? In machine deep learning, we have weights, nodes, whatever, right? These are the parameters we want to fit. And when we fit a function, for instance, a Gaussian or polynomial, we have a mean, a width, polynomial parameters, right? We talked about this last Tuesday. Then we have hyperparameters in machine learning or deep learning. This would be the learning rate, the number of epochs, the tolerance, and so on. Here it would be the order of polynomials, right? Do I include tails? How many fit iterations, right? In machine learning, we also have, deep learning, we have the optimizer, right? We talked so far about the steepest gradient descent. In fitting a function, the corresponding thing would be like, do I use a chi-square or log likelihood fit, right? This would be the optimization strategy. Data sets, training, validation, bootstrapping, same can be applied in fitting a function. In both cases, you have to do a performance evaluation, right? When you fit a function to your data, right, you look at the chi-square NDF, or you get the fit probability or whatever. Here in machine learning, we would use the accuracy or the mean squared error. Of course, either doing machine learning or fitting a function to data, the basic question is which model, which function do I use for my data, right? What I just tried to show with this table is that these two things have a lot in common, right? And they're not so different, one might think. The only difference is that the machine deep learning section has many, many, many more parameters. Right? As I said, it's not machine or deep learning is not much different to fitting a function. You have to understand your data. You have to think of which model is the best, which optimizer is the best, which variables do I put in. The reason why these algorithms are so successful and many people do these, amazing things with it, is because they just have a lot of parameters. Right? This is the secret. I mean, it's no magic, right? If you have a deep neural net with 1 billion parameters, I mean, of course, this thing will be able to steer a car, or say a bird is not like a cat, right? But of course, this doesn't come for free, right? You have to come to that point, right? Like I try to show you, you have to tune your hyperparameters. You have to think of which hyperparameters are the ones that impact my performance the most. Which hyperparameters do I have to tune, right? So again, nothing comes for free. It's a provocative statement. Machine deep learning is just basically, it's just a reduction of your problem, right? If we have, let's say, 1 million weights, you don't have to adjust them separately. What you just do is you adjust m smaller n parameters, right? Remember, we had this the neural net, the classification neural net with 40 parameters. Yeah, we just checked for 4 hyperparameters, right? So 4 versus 40. You just go down into a manifold of parameter space, but yeah, that's all to it. And depending on the data set, right? What kind of data set do I have? How large is the data set? How complicated is it? How many variables do I have to look at? Training a neural net or a deep decision tree or whatever can be much more challenging than a polynomial fit. I mean, of course, that's clear, right? One is obvious statement. But don't be afraid to use machine learning, right? Again, there's no magic behind it. It's no alchemy. You just have to know what you're doing. That's all. Then if you open questions, these are questions that people ask me here in the lab that I just bring up here in case you might ask them by yourself or have similar questions. So we talked a lot about data frames. And the question is, of course, if you want to use a machine learning model, do I have to use ultimately data frames in your analysis? The answer is no. You can, but you don't have to. Right? One approach is you can use the data frames to prepare your data for the model, train your model on it, and then once the model is trained, you can deploy it to your framework, right? This is, for instance, something we are doing in for GRUX. The model is trained with data frames in TensorFlow Keras, but then it's translated to a C++ class and then used in our GRUX internal software. Yeah, which framework is the best for me or which is the best to start with? That's a tough one. And as I said many, many times, it depends on what you want to do. There's one framework I did not talk about because it's, well, let me put it this way. If you just want to quickly filter your data, large amounts of data, like you're in a big company and you don't care about the performance, you just want to, filter spam mails or find the best product placement or what, then you would use Apache Spark. This framework is really good for handling large data sets, like billions and millions of data points, but it doesn't allow for much flexibility in tuning your models. There comes scikit into play, right? I hope I kind of showed you that scikit A has a lot of algorithms to look at, many, many decision trees, vector machines, likelihood estimator, Bayesian optimizer, whatnot. And you have some flexibility in tuning them. And I highly recommend to start here, actually, because you have enough variety to check many algorithms and many settings, but it's not too much that it's overwhelming you. Then we have TensorFlow. If you're familiar with machine learning, you should and don't know about it or haven't tried it, try it. If you're completely new to machine learning, you may not want to start with this one because it's a very flexible tool. I mean, it's great. You can do a lot of stuff with it, like really a lot of stuff. There are nearly no limits. The only limit is your imagination, but the flexibility is also killing it because sometimes it's just too much and you don't know where to start. So this is highly recommended if you really have to customize your model, like in our case in GLUX. And of course, many of these frameworks have overlaps, right? So especially in the low data amount regime, they are performing equally well. But they're all well documented, I have to say. Documented in a sense like they really transparently explain to you what is going on, how to manipulate each function, how to access each function. So they don't leave you alone. And again, the favorite question, which model shall I use for my analysis? Again, it depends on what you want to do. Do you just want to classify a small data set like the one we discussed here? Or do you want to, have a network that is able to produce music for you? You have to figure out what problem you try to solve. Again, there's no need to use a deep model with 10 to the 9 parameters if a random forest shows the same performance, right? If you have a data set and you use a random forest classifier with, let's say, 5 trees, and you have this gigantic big deep model, there's no use to tune this deep model, right? If the random forest already shows you 99% accuracy. On the other hand, if you see that your random forest is always at, 20% accuracy, then do not try to tune it until infinity. Then you might want to check a deep model. References and further reading. Here are the links. So all blue items are clickable links for the different frameworks I'm using or people are using. They're not only explaining the functionalities of their own framework, but they're also explaining like how is the confusion matrix derived or so. So they're also good on getting a feeling for machine learning. Distill.pub, this is something where current problems and issues in machine learning or deep learning are discussed. This is when you're really in the field and want to know what's going on or what are people doing for image classification, then you won't want to check this out. Recipe for training neural network, this guy, he gives lots and lots of tips on how to choose the learning rate and which optimizer and whatnot. So this is really helpful. And here's something I can really highly recommend. It's called Hands-on Machine Learning with Scikit-Learn, Keras, and TensorFlow by Orion Guiron. It's a really good book. He explains many things without using too much mathematics, not like me. But he explains very good. He uses a lot of pictures and gives a lot of examples, and it's a really good book. So if you can get your hands on this one, really good. Besides that, the Deep Learning for Science School, especially the first 3 or 4 introductory talks, they are on a very good level. So it's not too high level. There are some talks that talk about recurrent networks, and I remember there was this mathematician gave like a 2-hour talk on recurrent networks from a mathematical point of view. It was interesting, but it was tough. Also, might be trivial for you, but if you're stuck on a problem or don't know what to do, do not spend weeks to solve it. Again, I look up many things in the internet. I guess you guys do. I don't have to tell you, but you find it's amazing how many people you find doing the same stuff as you do and have already figured out something or have an idea how to approach something. Try not to start from scratch. This costs a lot of time, but sometimes it's not it's unavoidable. And then again, I don't know how to say, but there is no easy or quick way to learn all aspects of machine learning. Sure, you can watch this one YouTube video of a guy explaining the basic ideas of machine learning. This will work, but if you really, really want to go behind it, there's no easy way. My personal recommendation is try it yourself, meaning pick a data set and then, pick your favorite classifier or regression model or whatever and just apply it on the data and see what's happening. Vary the parameters, check the performance, and really try to understand what's going on. I think this is the best way to learn machine learning. Many people just read books and then claim to be machine learning specialists. I honestly doubt that because, learning by doing. This is the only thing I can highly recommend. Final remarks. This is my final slide, and then I stop talking. I talked a bit too long. I'm sorry for that. So this whole lecture just tried to give a rough impression on machine learning. Right? I did not cover all aspects of machine learning. There are so many things I could have mentioned, but time is too short, and they're also well documented in books and web pages. The code snippets I've shown here are not all best programming practice, right? So they're not optimized for efficient data analysis. They're designed in a way that it just shall show you the functionality of the corresponding framework or the idea behind a certain approach, right? Also TensorFlow Keras provides much more than I've shown here today. Yeah, I just focus on these dense layers, but it allows you to convolutional neural networks, the one you use for image classification. It allows you to analyze time-dependent data. So imagine you have a movie with changing pictures or what, you can analyze this with a recurrent network, and it allows to do so much stuff. So, yeah. Many things shown here are based on my own experience, so definitely not the ultimate truth, and someone else would have done it completely different. There's no doubt about it, but yeah. What I'm just trying to say is my what I'm telling you, parts of what I'm telling you is biased. Yeah. And most important, I hope you had fun. I hope I didn't scare you off. I know I used a lot of mathematics and got into details. I mean, you do not have to figure out these details on your own when doing machine learning. I just wanted to give you an idea on what kind of problems or things you might stumble when getting into this business. Yeah. And that's now all from my side.
Okay, very great. Anyone have any questions for Daniel?
Did you first start to learn through Scikit yourself?
No. I started learning with the root TMVA package by accident. This is also something. I mean, I don't know if I looked through some older lectures from Professor Dobbs and saw that you guys are also using root. So if you're really familiar with root, yeah, sure, you can check this out as well. It's also well documented, and they have also a lot of algorithms to play around with.
Yeah, but I mean, so they only used a very, very little bit of root here. So, you know, I mean, if you're doing a lot of your analysis in root, then it's very convenient. But I think for most people, you know, it's a little bit more convenient to, you know, work in Scikit or something like that. And so, anyone else? Any questions at all? Oh. Yeah, okay, if not, then